Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is November 21st. We have returning guests Daniel Lacaille, Angelo Gallo, and Ira Harris. Daniel holds a PhD in economics and is chief economist at Tresis SV, has been ranked in the top 20 most influential economists in the world. He's the author of several books, including most recently Escape from the Central Bank Trap and also Freedom or Equality. Ira is a past hedge fund manager and global trader in foreign currencies, bonds and commodities, equities for over 40 years. He served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. And Angelo is the founder and chief investment officer of Lifelong Wealth Strategies, LLC. He has 30 years of experience in the investment space. He serves individual clients and retirement plans, and he employs a global macro perspective to his investment strategy. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a global macro view on the economy and the financial markets. Daniel?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that from a macro standpoint, we have passed one of the big hurdles of uncertainty, which was the U.S. elections. And that makes it a lot less challenging to think of what's ahead of us, no? I think that the global economy is going to grow, well, in a very modest way in 2025, but I don't see any signs of a crisis. I think that all of the imbalances built in the public sector are going to continue. Central banks are going to remain hugely accommodative. From the view of Europe, there is very little to say about growth. I don't see anything mildly optimistic for 2025, apart from a small bounce in the manufacturing sector, which is going to come just from the fact that the base effect of 30 months of contraction will probably help. But I think that in general, what I would say is that things remain very, very, very much the way that they were a few months ago. Asia, strong growth led by India. China's going to be the first economy that will grow in the middle of a massive real estate slump. So it's going to grow around 4-4.5%, which is fine. And in terms of Latin America, very, very weak growth, if any. Brazil, Mexico, no growth whatsoever. United States, growth continues to be driven by debt and government spending. Let's see if the budget cuts and supply side measures announced by the Trump administration lead to a stronger economy. And I do not see any risk whatsoever for economic growth globally from the tariff impact. I think that the entire narrative that it's going to be a disaster is debunked by 2016 to 2021.
Yeah, very interesting perspective and points. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, there's so many people, and I think Daniel brings it forth, they're prognosticating about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even venture, until I see who's in place and who's going to actually be making these decisions, and who's actually acting in consulting and sitting down with this. I can't venture anything except to know that the debt is going to be a serious issue. Whoever yeah. has to deal with it, right? That's the one certainty. And then coupling with this, and I'm so glad to be here with Daniel, because it's time to visit the issue of Europe. And if you would ask me right now, Russian ICBMs are not the most important issue. We have politics in Europe that are so critical to global finance. Forget about, and that's part of the issue. So I am, I would like to see Scott Bessent in that seat, only because I think he comes out of an environment where he will have the intestinal fortitude and the creativity. And there is, if the media wasn't so damn lazy, they might actually write an article about this, because if you go back to 1999 to 2002, we have somebody very similar like Bessent, and that was Fraga, who came out of Soros and took over as the head of the Brazilian Central Bank. And if you remember from 1999 to 2002, that was a very tumultuous period for Brazilian finance. And then he stayed on to help Lula and he was a good source, because when you come out of a Soros, and I'm talking about Soros's finance, I make not one other statement, but when you come out of that, you do understand how the global macro world works. And we're in the global macro world. This is not just the United States, because I would argue Europe may be far more dangerous for the global financial system if things don't break the way that Draghi and Lagarde would like them to break. Hopefully we're going to get into that, the German elections. Now you have Le Pen threatening to bring down the French parliament, and believe me, she's relishing the desire. And you know, we have some problems in Spain, so they're going to have to figure this out, because if they don't figure out the debt issue in Europe, will make the United States look like child's play. We have history to see that. We saw 2012. So I think it's going to take somebody with a very creative mindset and a deep understanding of the global macro system to move ahead here.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you on that regard, Angelo, what are your thoughts? And also, I think you had a question as it relates to that, for potential for Europe to have a capital markets union, a fiscal union, you know, like a European bond issuance that could restrict the ability of each country to issue debt. Did you want to elaborate on that, Angelo?
Sure. Let me just start with the United States first and expand a little bit on what Ira was just talking about. Here in the U.S., from my perspective, we have a confluence of economic issues that are coming together simultaneously in a way that we've never had to deal with before. And what I'm referring to is interest expense on the U.S. debt vis-a-vis the $11 trillion since COVID that has been, you know, pumped into the U.S. economy, 5 million of stimulus, 2 million a year of deficit spending, 11 trillion and counting, which has caused inflation, or a contributor to inflation. Then you mix in the fact that the current Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, has toyed around with the issuance in the way that she funds the U.S. debt. And what she's been doing is issuing more treasury bills and less 10s and 30s. That's created a ton of financial liquidity, as I like to call it, that had one place to go, and that's into risk assets. Now, the question is, how does whoever the new incoming Treasury Secretary renormalize that issuance in the way of getting bills, the issuance of bills, down to its historically normal level of roughly 20% of total issuance without upsetting risk assets, right, here in the U.S. and globally, because that just means that if you're going to unwind all of that, there's got to be an unwind of leverage in the system. So all of these issues coming together at one time I'm having a really hard time seeing how there's a way through it without upsetting financial markets in some way. And Scott Bessent actually wrote an op-ed piece a week and a half ago in the Wall Street Journal, basically alluding to all of these things and saying, hey, look, we need to figure out a way to get through this without aggravating, his words, financial markets. And if we have a problem here in the U.S. and we have a problem with risk assets, it's certainly going to spill over into Europe and other places. Now, Daniel mentioned India. I agree with him completely. I was long India, full disclosure, for a year and a half. I've been out of India now for about 4 weeks because my process said they're entering into a more stagflationary environment right now. And the Bombay Sensex Index has gone bearish trend on my work, so I'm out of that. I never did, when we did that call with Dennis Gartman, I mentioned how China looked like it was ready to explode, and that's what it did the next day, interestingly. But I'm still not a fan of China for a whole bunch of different reasons. There's some countries that I'm short, Chile, Colombia, you know, those are hedges against, you know, some of my new energy longs. But that aside, I had suggested to Ira that, hey, you know, let's get Daniel on so we can have a deeper dive into the goings-on of Europe. And that's okay. Why I posed Daniel that question about the Capital Markets Union, because that's probably the most pressing issue in Europe at the moment, because they seem to view it as a way out. But before you answer, something interesting just came across the wires about 5 minutes ago, and it looks like Spain is going to join Italy in raising the tax rate on banks to 7%. Yeah. And my immediate thought there, Daniel, was that, maybe they do think they're going to have a capital markets union, right? And since we don't necessarily will need the balance sheet of the European banks as much anymore. Maybe this is a way to, you know, fund the fiscal side. So, begin with either Germany, the Capital Markets Union, whatever you prefer.
Okay. I wish that the Italian and Spanish politicians had the long view that you just mentioned. The only reason why they're increasing the tax is because they need desperately to find €1 billion of tax revenues, nothing else. And unfortunately, because they believe that banks are going to continue to lend regardless of the tax at the same pace. If there's one thing that governments always take for granted is liquidity. Now, Capital Markets Union, exceedingly difficult. One of the things that a lot of people have sort of viewed or ignored, a piece of news that has been ignored recently has been, at least in the financial world, has been the decision of Germany to start asking for passports at the border for anyone that's coming in into the country. Now, Germany is moving away from unification. That doesn't mean that it's going to abandon the European Union or the euro area at all. No way. But it's certainly less prone to these type of exercises, particularly when you read every day in the financial media in Germany that the EU Next Generation Fund, as predicted by me and so many others, has been an atrocious disaster all over the European Union, like the Juncker plan before it and the Jobs and Growth plan. So the fear of the Germans is the following, and there was a very good article on Hanselblatt about it, which is that the Germans have accepted the burden of inflation, expecting that would deliver stronger growth and higher productivity in the euro area, and now they have inflation, no growth, and no productivity. No? So I don't think that it's easy to move ahead with a capital markets union in the euro area. There's also a piece of legislation that makes it very difficult, which is this new European Union directive that is aiming at scrutinizing the source of financing within the system, which is going to entail a tremendous amount of bureaucratic burdens, and is more actually aimed at making it more difficult for a capital markets union than actually they intend to, probably. No, so it's very, very difficult. Very difficult. I don't see it anywhere, and I don't see and if there was a capital markets union, I don't think that would entail a challenge for Southern European countries to issue their own debt. I think that it would basically raise the eyebrows of the Germans and the Dutch about burdening their own economies with the debt of Spain, which is rising at about 4% per annum, in the burden of France as well. No, so I find it very difficult. I hear the benefits and the comments in political and economic discussions, but I don't see anyone actually aiming for it. I don't think that the Germans trust the French. They're going to have a 6% budget deficit this year when they promised a 4%. The Spanish are going to have a 3% despite record revenues. So I think it's very challenging. I don't see it short term.
Interesting in your thoughts, Ira.
Well, I love hearing Daniel speak about this, and Angel pushing the question to the fore. And the only reason that it really resonates is because, number one, we had Joachim Nagel give a speech a week or two ago, and at the end he comes to talk about capital markets union. And we know, yeah. I know Lagarde has talked about it. The ECB has issued a paper, and of course the great Draghi manifesto about 800 billion euros a year in fiscal stimulus coming out of Brussels. It can't be, in my mind, it can't be done without a capital markets union. And with capital markets union, of course, is the surrender of sovereignty to fiscal harmonization. I just don't know how they get there. And if
I don't see it.
And if they're not in a hurry, as Daniel points out, Germany is a real political problem at this juncture. Real political problem.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Daniel.
No. If I may add to that, I think that is another very important factor, is that after the collapse of the German government, the next election is going to be clearly a CDU government that is going to be very, very, very hard pressed by the Alternative for Germany, right? So I don't know. I agree with you that there are loads of talks about the alleged benefits of a capital markets union and addresses from the European Central Bank, economic papers, all these things. I agree with that. What I don't see at all is, okay, so we're going to do this, 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 and this. That isn't anywhere. You know, we just had for an excruciating long period of time, the parliament discussions of the new members of the European Commission. Nobody has talked about finance. Nobody. So I'm skeptical, and I think that the German elections are not going to help in that way. The extreme right, or how you want to call it, Alternative for Germany, is going to rise like a rocket. The Greens and the Liberals are going to sink. The Social Democrats may save a little bit their face. The CDU is going to rise, but the CDU is going to be a completely different CDU than the one that reached a parliamentary agreement with the Social Democrats. So I think it's a challenge. It's a very big challenge, and I don't think that anybody right now in Germany truly believes in giving up sovereignty in order to allow countries that have not controlled their finances have the same say as the Germans.
I think this.
I can't agree more with that. And I think, but does that not, so then, all right, so I totally agree with that. And I agree. And I think that the, and that radical left group in Germany, what's her name's party?
The Greens.
And so they're polling stronger too, but you have the AfD, and let's say that they do better. You know, we're talking about the MERS will be able to put together, MERS will be able to put together some type of coalition, because there'll have to be a coalition. Probably the best for Europe would be the CDU and the Free Democrats, because there was nothing wrong with Lindner, except he wanted to be a blocking agent in that stoplight coalition, because what else was he going to do? And he didn't want it running amok. And then, of course, the Greens weren't easy because they didn't want funding of Ukraine. So I think Scholz is, again, kind of like Schrader, he rolled the dice earlier, because if he had he not tossed Lindner to the curb, I think the coalition would have limped on through to its final conclusion in 2025, 2026, and we wouldn't have had the dissolution of parliament. But but I worry that if the AfD and from the extreme left get too strong, it's going to call the question on a lot of things that will really disrupt the global system and maybe cause a debt deflation as the European bond markets go through another reprise of 2011, 12, and 13. I don't know that we could take it now.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention this also relates back to our discussion with Bernard Connolly, who you mentioned the European Commission. Bernard worked for many years in the European Commission, also becoming head of the unit responsible for analysis of the European monetary system. And he's the author of the book, The Rotten Heart of Europe, that Ira mentions quite frequently. Ira, did you want to elaborate more on that, like the message of the book and how it relates to today?
Well, it's just, you know, it's of course what he warned about. And of course, because and Daniel and I have talked about this before, they did this all backwards. They should have had a euro bond, fiscal harmonization, and then the euro currency, but they were in such a hurry because, you know, Helmut Kohl was a force to be reckoned with, and the French wanted to make sure that they had tied up Germany. And so they get the currency done, because that was the area of least resistance. And here we are 30 years on, and we still haven't really, well, not quite 30, but the launch was January 1st, 1999. We're 25 years on, 26 years on, and they've gone nowhere. And they've been rewarded because, again, as I go through my list, you know, the fact that the Italian 10-year is 3.57 is, you know, considering, although Italy is a shining light, Spain is a shining light after they went through other problems. It's now the two workhorses of the EU, France and Germany, who are the greatest problem. And with that, others in the union are taking shots at them. It emboldens Orban. Yeah. It emboldens the Poles. They're emboldened because a weak Germany cannot bark back. And the French are, at this point under Macron, are pathetic. And that government could fall any minute because Le Pen is threatened. I mean, Macron will still be president because that's the way the French system works. But that government could fall. So you have these tremendous upheavals. And again, you know, to quote Rahm Emanuel, who seems to be resurrecting himself in U.S. politics all of a sudden after this election, but are you going to take this opportunity to finally get something done? And Daniel thinks absolutely not. It just can't. But if they don't, I really worry about the debt markets and how are they going to price European debt at the time. Am I wrong to worry, Daniel?
No, I think you should. I think you should, because there's a tremendous long exposure to duration in pension funds and investment funds throughout Europe, expecting a rapid decline in inflation and a rapid recovery of the economy without assuming that the surplus is going to be assuming that there will be no impact on the trade surplus. You know, the positioning of European fund managers is exceedingly optimistic. You know, on the one hand, nobody seems to see any impact on the surplus. I don't see any impact on growth, but I do see an impact on the surplus from tariffs. And obviously the surplus is a huge driver of what the euro is going to do, and in terms of the bond market right now is maintained thanks to the massive liquidity that you just mentioned before. The level of liquidity injected by the US Treasury has been inundating the entire market. So my concern is that now that all of those elements that you were mentioning before, Angelo, about the reduction in liquidity from the United States, where you're going to see them manifesting probably will be in the euro area and in Japan, no? Via the currency and via the bond market. So I don't want to take bets on the euro area market. First on the fundamentals, because the deficit is completely misunderstood. The most of the countries already have very elevated deficits with record tax receipts coming from inflation, no? Inflation leads to higher tax receipts because they don't adjust tax rates to inflation. So you can have a very quick and abrupt impact on the bond market coming from the reduction in liquidity from the United States, the worsening of the fiscal situation of France, Spain, Italy. I would say the three at the same time, and at the same time also the challenges coming from the German elections, which are very, very difficult. I personally think that both extreme left and right parties are going to rise like there's no tomorrow.
And you know, Daniel, I'm sure you saw it. The fact that the Volkswagen labor union wants to go on strike in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And in Germany. And I got to believe that just muddies the waters even worse.
Absolutely, it does. Absolutely, it does. There is a tremendous level of discontent within Germany about the massive slump of the industrial sector, which is their pride and joy. And particularly the automotive sector, which is self-inflicted. It has everything to do with the European Union's policies and the decision to stop manufacturing fossil fuel motors, vehicles in 2030, which has led to people not purchasing cars. And obviously the entire diesel market has been decimated. So every day in the news, it's interesting to see that it doesn't matter which country you look at. Every day in the news, alongside whatever you read about any other element, in the first page, there's always one tiny item of such and such car manufacturer is going to shut down yet another facility. So it is going to create a very significant turmoil. And because the CDU... And so the CDU is already sort of radicalizing its message, or at least being more, no, I wouldn't say radicalizing as in being more defined and less sort of social democrat. But I think it's going to be very, very difficult. And either the programs of the extreme left or the extreme right moving toward, oh yes, let's get together and join ourselves with the Spanish and the Portuguese to finance their debt. I don't see that happen. And particularly, I'll come back to the point. Just to finish very quickly. Sure, particularly sure. Because the EU Next Generation Fund was sold all over Europe as this massive, enormous, fantastic program that would strengthen the manufacturing, the automotive, the technology sectors, and the European Union would go back to growth. And it's been an atrocious disaster. I think that that's also, it adds to the sort of discontent.
Angela, did you want to comment on that?
In the past week or so, it was reported that Greece is going to prepay some of their European debt, and that they've, you know, gone through the internal devaluation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And appear to have right-sized the ship.
Yeah.
Is there any chance that Europe ends up being forced to go through a similar process in the absence of a capital markets union, right? And because each individual country now is left to stand on their own 2 feet. With respect to their debt and their ability to fund their debt and their social programs.
I believe
that there is no option. How do you avoid some sort of a massive deflationary impact like that?
I don't see any other option. You cannot avoid it because the European Union ignores the most important factor that is driving that deflationary process. The first one is being demographic, no? Is that pretty soon the European Union, 25% of the population is going to be older than 65 years old. The second is getting very close to Japan. Yeah? The second one is that we don't have the problem of Japan of losing population because there's a lot of immigration, but the immigration that is coming is creating tremendous discontent and is not driving economic growth or higher wages or higher productivity. And so I don't see any other option. I don't see any. You see, this is very similar to 2011, in which everybody understands that there are a number of things that could help, but no one trusts each other. And because the governments, instead of being more sort of left or center left or center right, they're becoming more extreme. You cannot count on the Italians to support the Spanish because the Spanish and the Italians are ideologically opposed. The French government is in turmoil. Nobody wants to reach an agreement with Macron because everybody knows that Macron is not in power anyway. So it's truly convoluted, and it reminds me a lot of, not in the same type of crisis, but it reminds me a lot of 2011, when you remember that everybody was sort of saying, oh, don't worry, we're going to have a summit next month and we're going to address all these issues. And they have the summit and nothing happens, no? So I think I am not optimistic. I would not take a long position in euro area long duration.
Wanted to show these charts. These are graciously provided by Judd Hirschberg of White Wave Trading, the trading room that we're in. Judd is the chief investment strategist. And just wondering in that regard, Daniel, like where do you see the short, medium term trends in the euro and bonds in the European Union?
I mean, there could be a short term bounce on the euro in the next ECB meeting. When Ms. Lagarde comes out, says what the market wants to hear, and then a couple of days later, the market finds out that she's not going to do it. No, but I would not be long the euro, considering that considering that this euro dollar exchange rate is fundamentally predicated on the fact that the euro area is going to continue to have a phenomenal trade surplus with the United States that is going to be decimated by tariffs, and tariffs are going to be absorbed by the businesses, as they did and as it happened in 2016, 2021. But tariffs mean that you need to purchase a lot more dollars. People see tariffs from the trade perspective. People see tariffs from the political perspective, but people don't see tariffs from the monetary perspective. The main reason why the Trump administration is implementing these massive tariffs is because it means that the European countries are going to have to buy an absolutely phenomenal amount of dollars.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Interesting. You know, Daniel, last week you tweeted a chart. I think I forwarded it to you, Ira. You tweeted a graph of tariffs worldwide.
Yeah.
And China was at the top of the list, and the U.S. was basically in the middle of the pack.
Yeah.
You know, and I think your point was, hey, you know what? The U.S. has room to wiggle because they're in the middle of the pack. They're not extreme. And then this morning, you mentioned that you mentioned the trade surplus of the Eurozone with the United States, and you mentioned that, you know, there's a different variety of trade barriers that the Eurozone puts up against imported American goods. And it was funny, you commented, you said, you know, they can either reduce some of the trade barriers or they can accept higher U.S. tariffs. And you said, I think that the Eurozone is just going to accept higher U.S. tariffs.
Yeah.
What made you think that?
Oh, history. Because tariffs are a very, very bad way to combat protectionism. And by the way, I don't think that Trump is implementing tariffs to combat protectionism. I think he's just trying to get revenues. The European Union, the message over and over and over everywhere in the European Union is that the European Union is this sort of free trade wonderland in which everything is great and that the evil Americans are going to put tariffs. But the reality is that I go down the street and I don't see American cars, that I go to my supermarket and there are no American eggs and certainly no American meat. So the point that we need to understand is that the European Union puts trade barriers using the environmental subterfuge. The regulatory subterfuge is virtually impossible for an American company to comply with all of the regulatory requirements and with a tremendous number of subsidies for the so-called strategic sector. So because they're not going to change any of those, and there's no political will to change any of those, let alone, and the least of them all, the environmental trade barriers, like in 2016 to 2021, they will mostly absorb all of the tariffs. There was very little negotiation. If you think about it, it was in the olive oil and in the wine. In the only two things actually in which the euro area actually took tariffs seriously and said, okay, we'll buy a couple more F-19s and you take the tariffs away, which they did. But everything else, I don't see it.
Your thoughts, Ira?
Yeah. Well, I mean, all of these are in play. So I think that Daniel's right, and I'm I'm with him on the tariffs. You know, again, everybody's quick to understand that Trump is a quote unquote transactional president, in which is everything's about a deal, which, you know, is not necessarily a bad way to run things, by the way. Historically, Lighthizer comes from that world too, because let's not forget that Lighthizer was part of the Plaza Accord going, you know, because he was in the Reagan administration, I think, as an undersecretary of Treasury. I could be wrong, or he worked in U.S. trade, but he was certainly part and parcel of that. So, and the Plaza Accord just came out from transactional, because they needed, with the Volcker monetary policy, the dollar got way too strong relative to the rest of the world. Again, that was based on relative interest rates and real yields, and it kept driving the dollar. You couldn't, and there weren't enough dollars. So they had to figure out, without going to an all-out trade war, again, why? Because the Rust Belt was becoming the Rust Belt. And they were trying to, and Lighthizer was aware of that as much as anybody. And push for it. Go back and read his work from that era. So here we are again. So are the tariffs transactional? You know, as Judd put up the euro yen chart, and the euro against the yen boggles my mind, because the Japanese have been working a weak yen, and I don't care what anybody tells me, by sustaining interest rates well below their inflation rate for quite a while now, the yen has stayed weaker. Now, this isn't Japan of the 70s and 80s, in which they're a mercantilist operation. They're just, there's so much more than that right now, because again, probably the most dynamic force in global finance are the Japanese, because they have so many investments around the world, if direct investment, and then just financial investments. So, and that's why we see when the world really starts to quake, what happens? The Japanese start selling assets abroad and bringing home money. And we saw that with the yen was phenomenally overvalued for quite a while during the, up until Abe of October 2012, but that was the situation. Now, I would say that the euro on a relative basis is quite overvalued with all their problems that they have. And again, you know, well, let's go back to what Daniel talked about, and it's the European debt markets. And don't forget, they issued 6, 7, 8 trillion of negative nominal ECB sovereign debt.
Yeah.
It's not long ago. And this is still in the system and filtering around the system. And then, of course, we had Teltro.
Yeah.
We had OMT. We had so many different things. And Lagarde, you know, I like to make Daniel laugh. Last time we laughed about Macron, but let's look at Lagarde. She's a politician.
Yeah.
And she's not, she was not put in, first she was put in the IMF to make sure that the French and German banks didn't get harmed with the Greek situation and the situation with Italy, Ireland, Spain, and Portugal. There was a serious situation. So they violated every rule of the IMF in order to bail out, because Europe is not a third world, and nor were they in that type of situation. But that was Lagarde protecting French and German banks, especially because they were sitting on so much of that paper. But as I like to kid, Lagarde is to central banking what Willie Sutton was to investment banking. You know, yeah, I robbed the banks because that's where the money is. Well, she has to go get the votes because she's, you know, it's not, an accident that she's the one who probably every conference she brings up, of her press conference, she brings up Capital Markets Union, because she knows where she has to get. And as Daniel has really wonderfully told us, can they get there? I don't know. But and Daniel says no, but if Germany really turns right, or France turns right, and those bond markets start to quake, because again, let's look at the yield. You know,
yeah,
Germany is 2.31, which is a laughing to me anyway, because with overnight rates, even though the German curve by itself, whatever it means, is actually turned positive over the last 2-3 months. But what happens here? And there's a lot of people, from banks to pension funds to foreign investors, lots of foreign investors sitting on this European debt in the anticipation that it's money good.
And yeah.
I was having this discussion with somebody today, back in, Daniel, the week after Brexit, Jerome Powell, who was only a governor at the time, but was in Chicago speaking at the what's called the Chicago Global Initiative, which used to be the Council on Foreign Relations. And he was speaking, and he was, again, a governor. So I was there because I was a member, and I'm listening. And after, then I asked him a couple questions. And the first question I asked him is, should sovereign debt carry a zero risk weighting? Because, of course, that was the Basel rules, and there's still a question about it. And he gave me his answer, and, well, that's the Basel. And then I asked him a follow-up question, which was, who guarantees the ECB debt? Mm-hmm. Who guarantees it? And without batting an eyelash, he said, they have a printing press.
Yeah.
Well, there are printing presses, and there are printing presses.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
And that's what Lagarde, and I don't minimize what, and you know it better than anybody sitting and even listening to this, what she has to confront to get this done. Oh, this is, and then of course you had Draghi drop that bomb with the $800 billion a year in fiscal stimulus, but whoa, and yet there is a lot of debt out there assuming the best outcome.
Yeah, I completely agree. From an investor standpoint, if you look at all the uncertainties that you want to deal with globally, and you see what is going on in China, you see what is going on in the United States, and all the things that we have been mentioning today, you have to be serial optimistic in order to be long the euro area.
And are you Polish?
Daniel, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
Ira brought up the negative yielding Eurozone debt.
Yeah.
How much of that do the European banks own? And the reason I'm asking is because if Europe doesn't get a capital markets union, and all of these countries get the bright idea of raising taxes on the banks, who I think their balance sheets would be further constrained in the absence of a capital markets union.
Yeah.
And if they're sitting on a fair amount of this negative yielding debt, that to me is, it doesn't bode well.
No, it doesn't. But it's going to go. I think, if I don't remember wrongly, out of the $19 trillion of negative yielding debt that were issued, that peaked in 2019, I believe, about 70% was euro area debt. And out of that 70%, about half of it was in pension funds. Okay. So. Mm-hmm. So the pensioners are going to have a real problem, huh?
Yeah. I mean, historically, pension funds and insurance companies don't worry me as much because, you know, they're matching assets and liabilities.
Mm-hmm.
We hope.
So, you know, that they can afford to wait it out because, in theory, new premiums and pension contributions coming in are just buying new paper at higher rates. And, and over time, in theory, it'll average out and work itself out.
Yeah.
But the European banks, that's what really worries me.
Yeah.
Because they're profitability constrained and they're balance sheet constrained.
Yeah. I remember that the infamous 100-year negative yielding Austrian bond that was issued 6 times oversubscribed.
Yes, it was.
Can you remember that?
And Argentina as well, I believe.
Yeah, Argentina was 4 times oversubscribed. But at least that gave you, obviously the nominal rate didn't care. But the Austrian 100-year bond was purchased mostly by Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, and Greek banks, okay? Because it was the safest asset to defend you from a contraction in equities and in other asset prices. So if you think about it, the countries that issued the largest amounts of negative yielding debt were probably bought by banks of the opposite side. So the northern banks purchased the negative real yield debt of southern Europeans because it had a little bit of yield, and the southern Europeans purchased the majority of the nominal negative yielding debt because that was the safest asset.
Interesting.
And further to the investment, and maybe last question for the podcast, Daniel, are you still bullish on gold and just cash in general, holding like U.S. dollar cash instruments? Or what are your thoughts there, like given the environment?
We have reduced a little bit our exposure to the dollar because it rose very, very fast, very quickly. But we continue to be net long the U.S. dollar. We're also long gold. We think that the correction has been exceedingly limited and very comfortable. We have reduced our exposure to European equities and to Chinese equities after the bounce, and we have increased our exposure to U.S. equities. And to the energy complex and to the small caps of the United States, the Russell 2000.
So,
okay, that's interesting with your firm.
So I just, you know, because when Angelo and Daniel were talking about the European bond market, I found an very interesting article the other day, Daniel. In the FT, they ran an article with the headline, Citadel Security aims to become material player in Eurozone bond trading. Now, I found it interesting because Citadel does not make many mistakes, and I've been looking for them to come but the ECB did issue some type of memorandum maybe a year or two ago that said that, you know, if you were going to be a big player in the European sovereign debt market, you needed to be domiciled in Europe, which I thought was a fair enough thing because they didn't want to be overwhelmed by the large investment banks and banks, Goldman Sachs at all, coming out of the U.S. So at least you should have a presence. So I'm wondering what the timing of that, you know, who's he talking again? This all comes together, and as you rightly point out, there's a lot of debt sitting in a lot of different places, though.
Yeah.
That is really, I mean, you know, people forget, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, but the Greek tenure went to 40% yield when it blew up John Corzine and Man Financial. I mean, we had the Italian, the French. We had rates up, especially the Italian, the 10-year, I think, was up to 8% at the time. Everybody else was at one. The U.S. was probably 1.5%, 2%. So you had significant issues. It'll be the
time. I don't think you're going to get a Greek-style crisis.
Yeah.
We're past that. The European Central Bank has made it exceedingly clear, and the anti-fragmentation tool works immediately the moment that there is any sort of discrepancy. Therefore, that's why I don't want to take bets on who wins and who loses. I see that all of them, you see what I mean?
Yes.
All of them are going to be dragged.
Fair enough. Lagarde learned her lesson in about 2 hours when she said, we're not here to close spreads, and the market exploded, and she retracted that. Yes, that is absolutely fair enough. How it settles out, that's a different question. And you and I and Angela are sitting here talking about with Richard, but there's somebody who's sitting on the banks of the Volga who may have a different viewpoint about how all this plays out and yeah. knows the vulnerabilities. So it's Europe is going to be a very interesting time. No wonder no wonder Ken Griffin with Citadel wants to get involved, because amongst all that chaos, there's going to be nothing but opportunities. So,
but you know, as an ex-Citadel person that still has very good relationship with the teams, every time that we speak about Europe, I always say, fair enough, convince me. No, tell me the long side. Tell me the, you know, we used to do that in Citadel. Give me in three sentences why I need to be long. And they start, because I think that and I believe that. No. So, you know, Ken Griffin used to say when I was there, it's either a long or a short. That's it. There is no such thing as a hold. Huh? And so I always say to my ex-colleagues, do it like we used to do it. Now, when I was in Citadel, analysts had to come up with a three-sentence recommendation on stocks, buy or sell, no other. Huh? Three sentences. This, this, and this. Not I believe that or I think that, but margins are going to go from 7% to 15% because of this, this, and this, or opposite, or it's going to go bust because it cannot pay back it, whatever it is. You know, what I find in Europe is that it's always, you know, it cannot be that bad. And I think, fair enough, you know, I live here.
Just continuing the roundtable insights. Ira, what are your thoughts on the investment environment, asset classes?
You know, I'm very cautious here. I think that if the United States is going to seriously deal with its debt problems, that asset prices will go sideways down in order to do this, because there is no easy solution. Again, whatever the Trump administration brings together, they've been left a mess. As they're talking about here, I've got things coming in right now talking about how much debt issuance has been in T-bills. And that's because, again, Brainard and Yellen, the thing they feared most in the 6 months coming up to the election was a failed auction. Now, as a trader and investor, to me, I would love to see a failed U.S. auction, almost like a trust moment. Because you have to kick these people in the teeth in order to understand how serious this issue is, and what by the Fed preventing it and with the Treasury, and I don't have a problem with Yellen and Brainard doing that, by the way, because that's a prerogative of the office and of power. When you win elections, that's what you get to do. That doesn't mean that it's best for those who you supposedly are serving, but that's what you get to do, and that's what they did. But it's going to be a mess coming in unless you continue to perpetuate that, meaning, of course, front-loading the auctions with that. But if you don't, you're going to run the risk of running a failed auction. And if I was the Secretary of Treasury, I wouldn't fear a failed auction. I would use it as a great opportunity to wake everybody up and explain to them, this is how serious it is. Now
good point.
Now the initial impact is, you're going to get the headline. Oh, U.S. rates jumped to 7%, whatever the number is going to be, and it's going to scare everybody. But that's what it should do. That's what markets are supposed to do. They're signaling mechanisms to signal to you there's a problem, and you better damn well deal with the problem. And it's actually early in the game. Don't let it fester for longer. You need to. So I'm cautious here, and you know what? If I miss the next 8 to 10% up in certain things, I don't care. I don't care because I can buy T-bills and get 4.5%. So I'll minimize my losses by somewhat. But there are stocks that I saw. I still you know, building on the Commerce. I still like Commerce Bank, and I'm not the one. But Germany. It's hard to like Commerce Bank, but it's holding up here anyway, even in a terribly situated Europe. But I look at Ken Griffin and go, why don't you buy Commerce Bank at a 20 billion capitalization, which gives you a domicile and a close link into the bond markets, and do what you want, sell off the goddamn branches and just, run the bank, but whatever, because I know there's a willing buyer out of Italy for some of it. So you need just a presence there. So I still like UBS. I think UBS's presence in Asia is unbelievably good, and they're going back to doing what they do right, managing money, and they can do it pretty well. They'll have to work off Credit Suisse. And there's other things in Europe. Europe defense stocks will be very interesting. I like Tokyo Mitsubishi Bank. I think it's very well positioned, and Japan is close to having to make some compromises with itself. And people forget Tokyo Mitsubishi Bank owns 23% of Morgan Stanley. So you're almost getting Tokyo Mitsubishi for, I won't say for free, but pretty cheap, because the American banks have done so phenomenally well. But I'm being very cautious. There are, I still like the ag because I think ag is just good going forward. One thing we know about China and India, they will feed their people. Yes, that's their main priority, because Xi understands hungry Chinese is not a good recipe for governing that country. And I don't care, how repressive you are, you do not want, and especially as they have a rising middle class, their ability to tolerate hunger is far less than it used to be, and it wasn't good then. So I mean, I'm very cautious around the world. I'm looking at, Angelo and I actually talked about it. So I'm watching U.S. Steel here, because I believe that deal is going to go through. I believe Nippon Steel is going to buy U.S. Steel. So I look at things like that, but I wouldn't be very aggressive. And I'm not telling people, oh, run out and buy these things. Go do your homework. I'm not here to do your homework, or to paraphrase the guard. I'm not here to close spreads. You go do what, I think that's the way. Caution, it calls for caution, because whatever way you deal with the U.S. debt situation is not going to be good for growth for, I think, 12 or 18 months.
Great. And Angelo, your thoughts on the investment asset class and what you like?
Sure. Let me just say, I have a very itchy trigger finger for every factor exposure that I'm long, given, the economic backdrop here in the U.S. that I started off with. So yes, like Daniel, I am net long the dollar, have been for a couple of months now, but probably for different reasons. My work shows inflation continuing to tick higher here in the U.S., not lower. September was the cycle low, as far as we're concerned, at 2.44. October came in at 2.6. November, we're looking for 2.8-ish, give or take a few basis points. And it continues from there throughout the first half of next year. So this transition that I'm looking at is one where the base effects are taking us to the rate of change of growth and inflation continuing higher from here. And at the moment, it does look like small caps, energy, industrials are starting to look through December and into the regime that I just described, coming on for the first quarter. With that as a backdrop, I've been reducing my gold exposure to a minimum position size, because gold historically does not like that economic regime. And if we go full blown, growth accelerating and inflation continuing higher, I'll eliminate my gold position. But again, all of that is with a very itchy trigger finger and subject to whatever economic moves President Trump and his economic team decide that they want to go with. If they decide that they want to attempt to cut the U.S. deficit in half, that puts the U.S. probably into a recession. because that $11 trillion of fiscal spending that I mentioned earlier, that's, in my opinion, what has kept the U.S. out of a technical recession. If you X out the G for government spending, the U.S. private economy has had rolling recessions, depending on which sector you want to look at, for the past 3 years. So I think they're going to have to do something with the deficit. If they can't or won't, you know, then that just means that we probably just stick with equities, whatever sector exposures are appropriate. You know, at this point, like I just said, it's going to be growth exposures, energy, industrials, select basic materials. And if the dollar continues higher, it'll probably be a reflection of the inflationary impulse that I see coming for the next 6 months, 6 to 8 months. And you know, a stronger dollar, that'll probably wreak havoc in other, you know, areas of the global economy at some level. But, you know, while we were talking a little while ago, the dollar had almost a 2 standard deviation move while we were talking this morning. And the euro, you know, got down to almost 104.5. And then the bond market back and forth. And now, you know, U.S. treasuries are trading lower again. So I don't know if that has anything to do with the headline that came across, Ira, that Matt Gaetz has withdrawn from Attorney General. That's a bad sign, not for Matt Gaetz, but I think it's a bad sign for the obstacle that Senate Republicans are going to put up for potentially other parts of Trump's agenda with specifically dealing with the debt. And if that becomes a problem, we're going to have some serious economic issues.
So let me just add one other thing, if I may. So one other area that I'm going to watch carefully, I'm not there yet, but is to watch Canada. Because if they get, there's another country that needs to get rid of an idiot, and he is a massive idiot, I don't know, Daniel, and has really led his country by things maybe 25 years in the future, but are not prominent now, and you're not saving the globe by cutting back your energy exports and natural gas and whatever, because everybody's going to get the energy they need somehow. So even the Germans will burn coal when they need to burn coal, that dirty brown crap, but they'll burn it no matter how green they are. So you want to be careful, but watch Canada here. And then, of course, the Keystone Pipeline will probably be day one that Trump puts back in place. These things will all be at some point positive. I'm not telling you run out and buy it, find your own ways, whether it's through buying the Canadian dollar, which is at a very, I have no technical levels in the Canadian dollar whatsoever, Judd Knight. I'm just looking at it in a big picture scope of a country that is really situated well. If the growth story gets better, they will really be situated well. And even if it doesn't, they've taken themselves out of the mix in a lot of ways. And if they put themselves back in the mix with LNG, and of course, with their agricultural produce and mining, it's a country without a people sitting, it's like Siberia, but much more inhabitable. And they can do a lot more with what they want. They've spurned investment because they've gone down a road of unicorns and rainbows, and we're just not there yet. So that's definitely an area in the world that I'm watching very closely. And outside of that, and speaking about what Angela just raised, I actually think that I thought he would never sustain himself, Gaetz, that Trump probably owed a favor to somebody. I'm taking the high road on that. And Trump figured, and rightfully so, he's not a hill worth dying on, as my dear Alexandra would say. It's just not a hill worth dying on. Get him out of the way. It's a problem. The problems are far bigger and more important than who's going to be your AG, you know, and I think that's actually a grown-up decision rather than why would you fight that battle? And so you're going to lose it anyway. Now, but it'll reflect. Now let's see who he's going to push to the forefront for treasurer, because I'm far much interested in that.
Richard, let me just add one last thing. The other factor exposure I like, Daniel, is Bitcoin. I've scaled in during October. Okay, and why? Well, the back tests on Bitcoin are that Bitcoin hates a regime where you have growth decelerating and inflation decelerating. We actually had that in the third quarter, and Bitcoin reflected that. Now we've got the reverse.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin is behaving exactly as it's supposed to in this upcoming economic regime. So that's also a factor exposure that I have. Yep.
You know, I'm going to raise one more issue, and this is if anybody's from the media and actually has access to Powell. At the next press conference, will somebody please ask him why he thinks gold has sustained such a high level, even as the Fed has won its battle against inflation?
Yeah. So he would blame the speculators.
So can Daniel and I get a press pass into the next one? You think they'll let us in?
No, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, great. It's been a great discussion. Can we just do it quickly around, like, how can our listeners, viewers learn more about your work, Daniel?
Well, very easy. Just Google Daniel Lacalle. It's easier to find me than to avoid me. I have a YouTube channel, YouTube website, yep. X. I'm even in Blue Sky now. So,
Okay. Great. And Ira?
I'm just doing podcasts. So most of the time at FRA, which really does, I think Yeoman's work, Richard, you're to be applauded. And Judd, thanks for the charts. They're absolutely great. You can come here, whether you're in the media, whether you're in the financial world. If you disagree, state why you disagree. And if it's a reason, if it's a responsible response, you will get a response. I read the email, but I only respond to things that are dealing with global finance. And when I got called out by somebody who was, concerned in my last podcast about my favorable comments about Lula, and I didn't speak about Lula from a Brazilian standpoint. I spent from a global perspective, and Lula is a very responsible analyst and actor on the global scene. And as I stated, he serves a role that Sukarno and Suharto, and of course, nobody better than Lee Kuan Yew, as being pretty astute player, because he has to position himself, and he has to position Brazil in a very rough world. And I think he does a very good job. Domestically, we can have all kinds of arguments, but if you write reasonably and ask for, you will get a response. So that's the only go-to. I'm really not blogging whatsoever, as much as I love Notes from Underground, but this is where you will find me. Thank you.
Yeah, good analogy. Indonesia and Singapore. And Angelo?
I'm not out in the public space for a variety of reasons. But if anyone wants to find me, they can go to my website, lifelongwealthstrategies.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For this discussion.
Yeah, oh, and Richard, you know what I do want to say? Daniel's one of my favorite economists.
Oh, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
So kind. Huh?
Yes.
You're so kind. There's a Christmas present going your way.
All righty.
Thank you so much.
A nice bottle of Spanish wine will do, Daniel.
Oh, yeah. I'm having Irish whiskey.
Both of you.
Thanks, everybody.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.